Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Indeed, I am back in New York City. Arrived early this morning. Happy to be in my studio, video streaming from our small studio. The large studio will be in a couple days. And because we're very busy working in there today on a lot of editing. In fact, we have six editors and six producers working on six different films that I've been on the road filming. It's wonderful when you've been on the road for such a long period of time to be back and grounded in being able to disseminate the information. And indeed, over the next 3 weeks that I'm in the city, I'll be doing a number of premieres, lectures, and I'll bring you up to date on all that as time comes. My guest today, I have two. The first guest at 12:15, right after our health and nutrition segment, will be Dr. John Etherington. Now, he is an environmental scientist. He formerly was the reader in ecology in the University of Wales at Cardiff. And his research was focused mainly on chemistry and physics of the biological environment. What are we going to talk about? Wind energy and wind farms. Are they the solution of renewable energy, or are they a scam? I believe that there is enough pro and con on both sides to explore this in depth. So he will be talking about wind energy. Now, this is particularly important because on the one hand, we have major corporations like Goldman Sachs and T. Boone Pickens and all those ads that you see on television about how good wind energy is. Well, there are some good things about good wind energy, but it depends upon where you put them. If you put them in some of the villages up in New York State, you've just destroyed the value of that person's property and the quality of their life. So we'll explore that. Second guest, Dr. Annie Kalajian, who's a board-certified expert in traumatic stress, is going to talk about an upcoming UN conference on nurturing resilient and sustainable communities. This is a lot of what I'm doing now, traveling around everywhere I can to find how are people coping in a positive way by developing skills, working together in sustainable communities. And then we're taking that worldwide. I'll be the keynote speaker at the UN on a Meaningful World conference. It should be very interesting, and she'll tell you all about that. Some commentaries today, an in-depth analysis of testosterone from William Falloon. Now, I'm very concerned that a lot of men would be a lot healthier and happier if they merely understood what happens by the age of 35 when your testosterone starts to go down, by 45 when your free testosterone begins to dissipate substantially, and your life turns upside down. We're not educating men on what they can do, natural and non-toxic ways of helping us understand how to get the testosterone back in our body. I have a series of commentaries I've been writing on the road, as well as those that I have found from other people. And I'll be sharing some of those today. Also today, an issue, and I'm going to ask you to call in and share your thoughts. Yesterday, the largest protest in Canada's history of students occurred. 400,000 people, mainly students, paraded through the streets of Montreal to protest government education policies and marched in a river of red to voice their opposition to a new law, Bill 78, seen by many as attempting to criminalize public protest and squelch free speech rights. Now, mind you, we already have these laws. I report on them almost weekly of what they are, what it will do to us, and no protest at all in the United States. There are groups. The American Civil Liberties Union is certainly doing a lot on it. But the American public is not, our youth are not, the professional class who should be aware of this are not. In fact, with the exception of a relatively small percentage of people, mainly the independent progressive movements, both conservative and liberal, we're not doing anything. So what does it mean when 400,000 people protest the very same loss of freedoms of speech and assembly up there, and we're not willing to do the same here? I'll talk about that. And also, I had a person on the road who I was filming who could not believe that we would have such a revolving door, meaning someone working in industry, going to work in the government, then back into industry, all the while being only there to protect the interest of the industry, hence the corporate profits. So today, I have prepared the most comprehensive list of just one company, Monsanto, and where their employees went and then back. Monsanto and federal positions, all powerful federal positions, and why we're not aware of it, but why it's very important. As you see, we have a lot to share. You can watch this program by going to progressiveradionetwork.com or GaryNall.com, either way, if you wish to watch. And also today, we will bring you up to date on the latest legislation. The latest legislation had Senator Durbin trying to sneak in a provision that would have virtually taken away all of our freedom of choice. And Ron Paul standing up and saying, no, the FDA should allow responsible and proven claims to be made. So if, for example, if eating cherries, if the scientific literature, independent literature, shows that eating those cherries helps reduce pain, you should be able to make that claim. Well, I'll show you the outcome of the vote yesterday. Now let's begin with the latest on health and healing. You've heard me mention that I believe that the ideal diet should be 75% raw and juiced, much of that, and 25% cooked, but lightly cooked. And it's the temperature that you cook at that makes a difference. If you cook something at a temperature like a sauce, where you could put your finger in it, where it doesn't get above, let's say, 140 degrees, then you've not only preserved the phytonutrients and chlorophyll and antioxidants, you've actually increased the bioavailability of nutrients, which is one of the reasons that any of you who come from a traditional Spanish or Italian or French or Greek background know that it's slow cooking. Generation after generation, you're shown how to slow cook. Also, they do what is called layered cooking. When you finish a dish, you should be able to remember multiple tastes, meaning taste should break down in the mouth, not as one taste, but as subsequent tastes as well, meaning you evolve. Oh, now I can taste the curcumin. Now I taste the basil. And if you cook right and then you present food right, it just doesn't taste one way. Because if you eat something that's deep fried, it just tastes crunchy and deep fried. If it's just sugary and soft, that's what it tastes like. And that's one of the reasons that we really enjoy Mediterranean cooking. For example, they will take olives, more than 150 varieties. And they will, some they will pickle, and some they will ferment. They then will shave these or make them into paste. If you go into some of the people's homes, you will see that they have little jars. And each of these little jars, maybe 4 or 6 ounce jar, has different olive paste in it. And then each one, like one might have lemon basil. And another might be a black olive or a green olive or a red olive. And it might have tarragon and mint. And they are masters of putting these in, but you don't put them in all at once. See, here in America, we make a mistake. We just put everything into a pot and we boil it, or everything into a skillet and we cook it at a high temperature. Big mistake. First, because when you cook something fast, you do not liberate the enzymes. And in the enzymes, when they mature through slow heat and hydrolysis, meaning light liquid, they release the pheromones and the oils, and hence the aroma, the sweet aroma. So that's why if you're eating the way ideally I believe you should, you're going to have more nutrients get into your body. Here's the latest on this. Antioxidant-rich tomato paste shows cardio benefit. This was published in a mainstream journal, Nutrition Research, and here's what it says. I'll quote, 2 weeks of supplementing the diet with a tomato paste may improve the function of blood vessels in healthy adults. This study was from Greece. Now, a daily 80-gram portion of tomato paste containing just 33 milligrams of lycopene was associated with improvement of medium blood flow dilation, and that's good. You want your blood vessels to dilate, to open up. You want your blood to flow smoothly through there. It's when our blood vessels calcify and harden, we get arteriosclerosis. And when we have blockages, we get plaque formation. And we get little lesions, we get scabs on the inner epithelial tissue. All that interferes with blood flowing evenly through an artery or vein, and the blood is flowing to feed the organs and feed the tissue. Now, what is a tomato paste? A tomato paste is tomato that was slowly cooked and rendered down. So then you get a very sweet, natural substance that is richer in lycopene because it actually liberates the lycopene. Interesting, if you had a raw tomato, you would not get as enough, the same amount of nutrition as a lightly cooked one. But now 70 grams of tomato paste is not a lot. That's only 2 ounces. Well, if you had a pasta dish, the sauce is going to be more than 2 ounces. So that's why tomatoes and tomato paste, that you can add different seasonings and change the whole taste of it. And you can add different olives, and olives as a paste, olives diced up, and change the taste. Mushrooms. Go to the farmer's market, and you'll find 40 or 50 different types of mushrooms. And that would be terrific. By the way, that's a good way to have a home-based business also, because you can grow mushrooms in your basement, you can grow them in your attic, you can grow them on your back porch, and then take them to the farmer's market or sell them to restaurants. But that tells us to stop a moment and look at the quality of our cookware. What kind of cookware are you using? Hopefully it's stainless steel or glass, and hopefully it's not one of those skid-free stick-free surface areas stuff, nothing with aluminum. This is the latest on this, and this is from Isaac Elias, and it says, as an integrative physician, some of the most important recommendations I make for my patients include advice on diet and healthy eating. But what about healthy cooking? Cooking techniques that can increase nutrient availability are certainly an important part of a health-promoting diet. However, many people don't consider the fact that some cooking methods can also increase the presence of toxins in their meal. A significant number of consumer reports and scientific studies have revealed the presence of harmful carcinogenic chemicals and heavy metals in aluminum and other nonstick cookware products. Peer-reviewed research suggests that certain nonstick chemicals can contribute to cancer, birth defects, flu-like symptoms, elevated cholesterol, abnormal thyroid hormone levels, liver inflammation, weakened immunity, and other problems. Now, what you want to stay away from are the non-stick cookware chemicals, what are called PFOA. And it's actually an acid. It's the main chemical used in the manufacturing of most non-stick coatings. And it's also present in numerous types of food packaging and in materials that are fire-resistant and able to repel oil or stain or grease or water. And this feature might appear to make them ideal for use in nonstick cookware. However, scientists have shown that the moment something is heated, it releases gases, and that's harmful. So, stainless steel, that's good. And you don't have a problem with that. Aluminum, that's bad. A normal intake of aluminum is about 3 to 5 milligrams a day, but Americans ingest 10 milligrams per day on average. So if you store anything, it's acidic in aluminum, aluminum pots, aluminum pans, not good. There are lots. Cast iron is good. It's safe. Ceramic is very good, or porcelain-coated cookware. It also allows for more even heat distribution, and it's non-reactive, meaning it won't release compounds in the food. Glass is the most inert, meaning it will not leach any chemicals or metals or other harmful ingredients into your food. Tempered glass cookware can be used at high temperatures. And then clay. Unglazed clay cookware was once a kitchen staple throughout much of history, and today serves as a more natural cooking alternative. So those are the things you can use. Also, curry should be one of our regular items we use to season our food. There's a new biological role identified for a compound used in ancient medicine. This is from the Oregon State University. Here's what it says. Scientists have just identified a new reason why some curry dishes made with spices humans have used for thousands of years are good for you. New research at Oregon State University has discovered that curcumin, a compound found in the cooking spice turmeric, can cause a modest but measurable increase in the level of protein that's known to be an important innate immune system benefiter, helping to prevent infection in humans and other animals. It's an antimicrobial peptide, and it's called cathelicidin, and it's very important for our immune system, and it's in curcumin. This was published in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry. Well, of course, the people in this audience know for a long time that I've been suggesting anywhere from 800 to 7,000 milligrams of curcumin a day. It has a lot of good benefits, including stopping many of your DNA from being altered and damaged. And finally, feeling strong emotions makes people's brains tick together. This is from University School of Science in Finland. I'll quote this. It says, research team at the university has revealed how experiencing strong emotions synchronizes brain activity across individuals. Human emotions are highly contagious. Seeing others' emotional expressions, such as smiles, triggers often the corresponding emotional response in the observer. Such synchronization of emotional state across individuals may support social interaction. When all group members share a common emotional state, their brains and bodies process the environment in a similar fashion. Well, I think we've all known that. We didn't need a study to prove that. When you smile, others smile. When you're angry, others can become angry. And what I would add to that is I don't believe that we are separated by time and space. I believe that there's a natural synchronicity between individuals. And that's why we should always think and feel the best for all the people that we can. It makes a difference. At some point, I'll go into depth about an experiment I did years ago to try to prove this. Just very briefly, I had a group of individuals do absentee healing to see would they be able to influence the outcome of some mice that I had borrowed from a lab that was doing cancer research. And these mice had very short lives. And in almost 30% of the cases, repeatedly, those who did absentee healing for humans in their own prayer sessions were able to influence the outcome of those mice, and the mice lived. So that was rather remarkable. And then I tried to get it published. And even though it met all the criteria for a proper scientific experiment, we did it 6 times over a year and a half. Nothing changed in the model. And yet the editors were so incredulous that this couldn't possibly be true that they simply didn't publish it. So now you know about it. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us.
Ever
I'd like to welcome all of you to our program. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting live from our studio in New York City. And my guest in the United Kingdom is on the phone now, as I mentioned earlier. He is Dr. John Etherington. He is a retired environmental scientist, formerly a reader in ecology in the University of Wales at Cardiff. His research was focused on the chemistry and physics of the biological environment, and since retirement, he has spent time investigating the claims made for wind power and other intermittent renewable technologies. His earlier career started at Imperial College of Science and Technology, University of London, where he obtained his doctorate in soil water and plant growth. He also served as the editor of the Journal of Ecology. And during his professional career, he authored several textbooks, including The Successful Environment and Plant Ecology. And in 2009, he published The Wind Farm Scam, an ecologist's evaluation. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, Gary. Good to talk to you.
Now, I will only ask you to answer any question as you have seen it from your own research in the United Kingdom. And then we, the audience, will determine how we want to interrelate that to our own wind farming here in the United States. All right?
That's fine.
Here is the issue. When we look at everything involving the creation and operation of a wind farm, how much of the CO2 does it really eliminate or lessen? And when you also look at a sustainable energy, how realistic is it to have something that only works sometimes and therefore can't be relied upon to work on a consistent basis in most of the environments that they are in? Your thoughts, please.
Well, let's look at the second question there first. They only work part of the time. It's not quite as simple as that. The wind sometimes doesn't blow, and so they don't work then. But for a very large proportion of the time, the wind will be blowing less strongly than they need for maximum generation. And, of course, the wind varies, so generation goes up and down, and those changes have to be dealt with by the equipment which you install on your transmission system. Let's just sort of put it into another format for a minute. Suppose you were a very rich man and you were going to buy a power station as part of your investments. If you knew that that power station that you were going to buy would be short of fuel at unpredictable intervals, in quite short intervals, over a long period of time, you would not even consider investing in such a venture. And my feeling, as the reply to your second part of the question, is that I feel exactly the same about wind power. We are investing in something which requires so much attention to back up and dealing with the intermittency that it may well not be worth doing. So that's the answer to that bit. Your question about CO2 is much, much more difficult. In this country, in the United Kingdom, our government has repeatedly made the point that one unit of electricity generated by a wind turbine replaces one unit of generation from some sort of conventional coal or gas generation within the system. That is not strictly true, because if we have to provide the backup, which my first part of the answer makes the point about, if we have to provide the backup, that is in fact going to be burning fossil fuel and in itself generating carbon dioxide. It cannot be turned off power stations take so long to warm up from cold that we can't simply say, the wind is not blowing now, we'll switch a power station on. We have to have a power station there which is hot and running and ready to take over. So it's certainly not the case that one unit of electricity from wind replaces one from fossil fuel. I don't know if all that answers your question.
It does. Thank you. Wind farms contribute to the destruction of ecosystems and habitats, and I have seen that in the United States because rarely will you have anyone invest in a single 400-foot high tower, and rarely are local communities given the full understanding that, one, that these are 400 feet and they weigh tons. Secondly, they make noise 24/7. Third, they're going to depreciate the value of your property substantially, going to kill a lot of birds, and also, if a part breaks on it, this represents a substantial danger to anything that's in the immediate area because they're very heavy. Now, where we have seen wind farms in certain areas, upstate New York, the people were given some idea that this would be financially good for the community. But across the United States, my research has shown that less than 2% income that is derived from the manufacture of electricity by these wind, these power stations actually go to the community. And then they get the person to lease their property for small amounts of money, but in a troubling financial times, especially for people who may have had a second home or primary home that no longer have an income, it's very tempting to give, say, well, okay, I'll get $1,000 or $1,500. But once you give them that money, you can't control where they build on your property. And I've seen windmills built so close to a person's property, they have no quality of life. Then you have the physical illnesses that occur. So I've looked into this from that perspective. Now, I have to set that aside from the idea, if this were really a beneficial technology and they could put it in the Great Rockies, where it's windy all the time, especially Continental Divide, where you ever fly an airplane across the United States, you know when you're in heavy turbulence when you go across Colorado, the Great Divide, or out into the oceans. But generally, that's not what they're putting in. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, there are a lot of questions there, Gary. Let me just get my thoughts together. I'll grab that last bit first about putting them out in the ocean. This, of course, is happening in the United Kingdom. We are putting a great number of wind turbines out into the, particularly the North Sea, which separates us from continental Europe. And on the Atlantic side of our country, we're also installing wind farms at sea. It solves one problem. It solves the problem of the person who says, I don't want this close to my property, or I don't want my property to be devalued by the presence of this wind turbine. What it doesn't, of course, solve at all is the question which we dealt with before, the question of the usefulness of wind electricity, which is so variable and intermittent that it needs constantly present fossil fuel backup. So though many people have hailed offshore wind power in Europe as solving some of the problems of people objecting on the basis of landscape destruction and noise generation close to habitations, it is not entirely as friendly as you might think putting them out at sea. So that's one aspect. Now, what were your other earlier questions there?
Well, let me use a real simple example. If you look at the actual science, including the work of Nina Pierpont, you'll find that secondhand aerodynamic noise. Now, the industry has put on a beautiful campaign showing there are no health effects to wind turbines and wind farms. And yet there's a lot of evidence showing absolutely that there is, that you actually end up with a syndrome. It's called wind turbine syndrome. And if you live in an area where you have one of these wind farms, you hear this whoosh whoosh, whoosh, every 2 seconds of the day, and it never stops. And that pulsating vibration that goes out is enough to cause people's central nervous system damage, and they can't sleep. And also, environmentally, one of the most important creatures on Earth for insect eradication are bats. And yet in Appalachia, where I come from, and also in other areas where you have a lot of bats, mainly in California, we have a lot of bat caves, they're essential to keeping down insects. And yet all over California and Appalachia, where you have these wind farms, massive kill-offs of bats because they fly into these. And they get killed. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, this is true. I'll come back to bats in a second. Yes, I'm familiar with Nina Pierpoint's work and wind turbine syndrome. It is a very interesting point that you raise, that the industry itself assures us repeatedly and very vociferously that there is no problem. And like yourself, I do not believe this. The work which Dr. Pierpont has published does suffer from one particular problem, and that is that it is self-reported information, information reported by people who live near wind turbines and have developed symptoms. That's the criticism, well, one of the criticisms which the wind power industry uses, and they suggest, good heavens, they suggest it's an imaginary syndrome. But if you look at, if it was any other sort of epidemiological study of an illness which was cropping up, not just in America, but across the world. Australia has many reports. We have reports in this country, in the United Kingdom, reports from Europe of the same sort of thing, and a whole host of symptoms, such as migraines, motion sickness, vertigo, visual disturbance, gastrointestinal constant upsets, inability to sleep. All of those things are reported again and again, and it is at a stage now where I would feel that a properly funded and critical research program is needed to sort this out in non-self-reporting situations, where, in fact, you take random groups of people and look at their present health status and their proximity or non-proximity to wind farms. I think the whole point about the Pierpont study is that there has not been money available to do this sort of work, and I'm certain that that's necessary. So that's what I would feel about that aspect.
Okay.
If we come back to bats, yes, bats have turned out to be much more vulnerable to wind turbines than perhaps we would have thought a few years ago. They are vulnerable not only by collision with the rotating blades of the rotors, but they are also very, very sensitive to the downwind turbulence which follows down from the turning rotor. The rotor can only extract about 50% of the passing energy, wind energy, and what passes by the rotor and through the rotor is then discharged as a stream of turbulence, like the wake of a ship, behind the turbine. And bats have proved to be extremely sensitive when caught up in the turbulence, in that it causes rupture of blood vessels and death, simply from bleeding to death, without any impact at all. The numbers are, in fact, quite disturbing. I was only reading today a study in Pennsylvania and West Virginia, based on just 63 turbines for 6 weeks, which have caused 2 and 2,200 deaths based on picking up the bodies of the bats, and that, of course, doesn't allow for losses to scavengers and losses to bodies which cannot be found. So, yes, I agree entirely with you. Bats are very much at risk, and you made the point of their influence on getting rid of harmful insects. Yes, that is very true.
And they also are they assist in the pollination process, as do birds.
That's right. Well, yeah, go on.
Yeah, because they have a voracious appetite and are very good at eating insects and also eating fruits, and then that becomes a part of the discharge, becomes part of the reseeding process.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you very much for being on and sharing your insights and your work, the Wind Farm Scan and Ecologist Evaluation. All the best to you and getting this message out.
Thank you very much, Gary.
From the United Kingdom, Professor John Etherington. And just one other thought. I think that the biggest problem, at least for Americans, is that there'll be a substantial reduction in the value of your property if it's anywhere near one of these wind farms. In fact, some of them have just plummeted off the chart entirely, where their house is worth nothing or their ranch is worth nothing. Once again, when looking for property, make sure you look for your mineral rights. Make sure you look for all the rights that the average person would never think about. Because otherwise, let's say you buy a property. Let's say you buy an ideal, beautiful piece of property in a sustainable area with no nuclear places around, and it's no near, let's say, a progressive community. And then one day some trucks pull up on your property, and they're there to put up a gas hydrofracking well right next door to your house, 50 feet away. The law's on their side. There's not a thing you can do about it. All right? That's why you make sure you have your mineral rights. Mineral rights meaning water, gas, oil. For those of you who would like to listen to this radio program over the radio, you can. Excuse me, over the telephone, you can. 832-280-0066. And because we're a very transient society, not everyone can sit in front of a radio, terrestrial radio, and that's not going to be the future. The future is wireless communication. Then this is an important number to have, 832-280-0066. Now, I mentioned earlier that in response to a person that was seemed rather incredulous that we could have any one corporation have such an important part to play in policymaking in the government, I decided to give you one list. Now, these are actual people, and this is just Monsanto, one corporation. And here are some of the people that you didn't know were important. The head of the government affairs of Genentech, now Monsanto, David Beyer, chief domestic policy advisor to Vice President Gore. Work for Monsanto's legal team, William Conlin, Department of Justice. Work for Monsanto's legal team, Sam Skinner, Department of Justice. Executive Vice President, Chief Technology Officer, again, all Monsanto, Robert Fraley, serves as an advisor in public agencies, including the USDA. Michael Friedman was Vice President of Clinical Affairs at Monsanto, Acting Commissioner for a period of time at the FDA. Director of International Government Affairs, Marcia Hale, Assistant to President Clinton and Director of Government Affairs. A consultant to Monsanto's public relations firm, Arthur Hayes, previously was FDA Commissioner. Now, I have about 40 more people who work for or part of the top echelons of Monsanto, who ended up including William Ruckelshaus and Donald Rumsfeld. Remember him as Secretary of Defense? Well, he was at one time CEO of Cereal, merged with Monsanto, and then he was successful in getting aspartame legalized in that position. And then, of course, Michael Taylor now. So virtually all the high positions in the FDA and the USDA. Oh, did I mention Hillary Clinton? That's correct. Rose Law Firm. She was Monsanto's counsel. Did you know that? No. Well, wonder what her pro position is in trying to get our U.S. State Department, which she is Secretary of State, by threats. that any country in the world that declines to participate in buying and using and advocating genetically modified organisms could end up having all kinds of backroom problems with the United States. So understand how it works. And by the way, the director of Monsanto's Danforth Center, Roger Beachley, he's director of the USDA's NIFA Center under Obama. So you have Hillary Clinton. You never knew that association. And now when she's out there around the world promoting quietly genetic engineering, and then we find out from WikiLeaks all these cables about how countries were threatened with reprisals if they didn't really get behind genetic engineering. Now you know the connections. But we have over 40 of these names, and that's unfortunate that our government is literally nothing more than, well, it's a pawn by these heavy-duty players. Now, a couple of other issues from our environmental segment. This is from Common Dreams, and it's their staff, and it says, ignoring protests and warnings, President Obama ushers in an era of unprecedented Arctic drilling. The president, who once promised a transformative approach to environmental policy, has succumbed to tired thinking and political opportunism, say critics. Quote, President Barack Obama, who once elevated the hopes of many U.S. environmentalists by promising to be a transformative president, one whose term he said would mark, quote, the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal, may yet be the president remembered for passing on a potentially historic opportunity to end or at least curb the practice of dangerous offshore drilling. And then it goes on to talk about how he has, in his administration, opened up all the oceans and everything to offshore drilling, especially into the Arctic. So at least someone's getting the message out. And finally, this is our issue of the day. And I'd like for you to call in and share your thoughts. And right after I share this, then our executive producer, Richard Gale, will give you a few insights on some legislation that just passed this week that most are not aware of. This is from Quebec, Common Dreams. Quote, Quebec protests resume after mass arrest. You're not the pot, we are the spoon. Montreal protesters held a government. In Montreal this week, 400,000 people paraded through the streets to protest government education policies and marched in a river of red to voice their opposition to a new law, Bill 78, seen by many as an attempt to criminalize public protests and squelch free speech rights. It was the largest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history. Thousands took to the streets with pots and pans in a jovial but direct challenge to the law. In a mass arrest, over 500 people were surrounded by police, detained, and arrested. But the protesters came back, showing no signs of backing down after the mass arrest the night before. Students again hit the streets in defiance, again banging pots and spoons, and were joined by diverse members of the community in a show of solidarity. Some walked with the protesters through the streets, while others banged and clapped from the balconies as the marchers moved past. Students were joined by retirees as well as families with children, all marching in a festive atmosphere. Quebec Premier, you are not the pot and we are not the spoon, one banner read. Being fined for protesting and demonstrating is silly. I'm not afraid of being arrested for fighting for democracy, said one 19-year-old. Okay. Did you know about this? Some of you would, because you are listening to a progressive radio program, the most listened to progressive radio program in the world. And so we're up on as many of these issues as possible and helping lend support. But did the mainstream media talk about this, show you this? And if they did, what was their perspective? Did anyone identify that we have laws now and executive orders now in the United States that make it illegal, a felony, for you to protest if there is a let's say the president is somewhere and you want to protest something he has done. You could be arrested, and that could be under a terrorist list. If a foreign head of a government, one, for example, from Yemen, comes here and is at the UN and we want to protest that, That now, according to the new law that they passed, means that you are in violation of the law, and that's a felony with years in prison. So why don't we have protests? We don't have 40 people, let alone 400,000 protesting. We do have some idealistic younger people, college students, but look at it this way. Why don't we have the Occupy movement focus all of its attentions for a few months on putting up all the information about why they're paying such high interest rates, what happens when you graduate and you can't get out of that debt? What happens if you don't pay back your bill and a SWAT team shows up, as has actually happened? How about the 27 states that have debtors' prisons, and how the for-profit privatized prison corporations are looking forward to a bonanza of college debts not paid and students in their jails? Why not go on strike against the corruption of the for-profit higher educational institutions passing on expenses? Why do we have to pay all this money? We're not even asking, why should we be paying all this tuition to begin with? Where does it go? When you're in a hospital and someone says, oh, this hospital room for a night is $2,000 and your operation is $25,000, why is it $25,000? It's going to take you 3 hours to do it. Who's making that amount of money? Why does it have to be that amount? So I believe that focusing with students, from students, in a general protest and going on general strike, and then all the union members and all the faculty, most of whom are union members, in solidarity go on strike at the same time. One national issue, privatization of education, usurping our rights, and then not being able to get out of debt through legitimate bankruptcy, all because the special interest lobbied through ALEC. They got their way. They controlled the state legislations, the federal legislations, and you got nothing. So if they can do this in Canada, why can't we do it here? That's my issue. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. We'll look forward to your calls now. Let's go over now and say hello to Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. Just want to bring listeners up to date to something we actually missed, because this was the last midnight hour kind of sneak that Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, snuck into an existing bill, an amendment that would have essentially made it almost impossible for the majority of supplement manufacturers of natural products and vitamins and minerals and herbs to be able to comply with these demands, and would have forced them off the market. Now, the good news was that the amendment was voted down by the Senate by almost three quarters of the vote. But this was the curious thing. Every one of the 20 senators that voted for this amendment are from the Democratic Party. There is not one Republican.
Al Franken, all of them.
Al Franken, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, Harry Reid, and surprisingly, Bernie Sanders. Yeah, who, you know, independent from Vermont.
But on one level it doesn't, because time and again, I've seen it when it was up against going against the terrible policies of teen screen and having mandatory psychiatric testing or mental health testing of all Americans. It was Republicans who voted against it. It was Libertarians who voted against it. It was the Democrats who voted for it. The Democrats have repeatedly voted for expanding the power of the FDA. And maybe when they see this new film I have coming out, maybe they might rethink their position of supporting the pharmaceutical industry, a drug for every problem, and the FDA, because they're on the wrong side of truth. All those Democrats are absolutely wrong. And yet the liberals, corporate liberals, will support them. The independent liberals and progressive liberals will not. So thank goodness we defeated that part. But one part got defeated, and that was Ron Paul's part.
Well,
which
actually, it was Rand Paul's. Rand Paul's was another amendment he was trying to get on the floor for vote, which would have reined in the FDA to kind of restore the freedom of speech.
Man, we need that.
And that would help freedom of speech. And that would have been for preventing the FDA from its Gestapo tactics and bullying farmers, sellers of raw milk, and going after the producers and health food stores.
Well, fortunately, we're going to keep on top of all this to let people know what legislation that would adversely affect your freedoms are going on. Now, I haven't been able to get word about our guest. Don't know if we're going to have her up in a moment. But if we can find her, we will. Otherwise, let's say hello to Pius from New Jersey. Hi, Pius. No?
Hello.
Hi, Pius.
Yes, I have a question for you. People like to talk about 99% and 1%, and I really don't look at it that way myself. But my question for you is this. Isn't it inevitable, really, that there will be a segment of the population, the so-called 1%, that just manage wealth? They live in that environment, they live in that world, they're completely detached from everybody else, from production, distribution, and so on and so forth. They will never really know what goes on in the rest of the world. Isn't it inevitable that that's how life is just going to be?
I don't believe that it is inevitable. You raise an interesting point, and I thank you, Pius, for raising that. But I see that too many average people, or what you would call the 99%, are equally disconnected. They don't know what's going on around the world. They don't care what's going on around the world. They're not stopping the home foreclosures. They're continuing to vote for the very people keeping their money in the banks, their credit cards in the banks. They're closing their neighbor's home and may close their home. This is not a matter of the Stockholm syndrome, where you identify with your own captors. This is simply indifference, and we need to get out of our indifference. Whether we're the 1% and or the 99%, we have to start to care about other people other than ourselves and become aware of issues. Yeah, it takes some time. You have to give up something, so you sacrifice something. It's an exchange. I won't watch these reality shows so I can educate myself on the world I'm living in. And if that seems like a painful exchange for some people, well, see how painful it is when some crisis comes in the near future and you're fully unprepared to deal with it. Thank you, Pius. I appreciate your input. Dave from Brooklyn, your turn. By the way, Dave, let me just mention quickly, I was just told that we managed to get 7 people who were signed up for the big showing that I have coming up, the premiere of my new hardest-hitting film, on whatever the date is. I'll get that date in a second. So we do have some seats. And if you want to come that night and join me and a panel and see this really powerful film, so powerful we're not even allowing a trailer up to be seen because we hit so hard at so many different institutions. Oh, you won't want to miss this. You can call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. I believe it's a Friday night, June 15th, I think that is, right? We have room for 6 people. Dave, please continue.
Gary, how are you feeling?
Great, thank you.
I think a strategy that could be implemented on raising people's awareness, because one of the problems from what I see is that people are simply not aware. They're not made aware of the right information. I think if a cataloging of how many times the government with the corporations have systematically lied to the people, at least since the founding of the government, if they could be aware, if they have some way that they can see it.
Okay, they can. A good question, Dave. Have you listened to the 5-hour award-winning series called Intervention? Then I suggest you do, because it documents from the beginning till now everything we've done, at least in one area, intervening around the world in the name of democracy, freedom, and justice, where none of it was for that reason. It was neocolonial expression, and we caused massive suffering. There's a good way of starting that lesson. I'm told now that my guest is on the line, so we'll go over now and say hello to Dr. Annie Kalajian. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Dr. Gary Null. How are you?
I'm fine, and I'm looking
it's
forward to...
connected with you. I've been trying to personally speak with you about our exciting conference at the United Nations.
Well, I want people to know that on June 14th, which is Thursday, from 1 to 5:30 p.m., at the United Nations, in the United Nations Church Center, at 777 United Nations Plaza, there will be a really what I consider very, very meaningful day, and where the whole theme is a meaningful world. And I will be there as one of the keynote speakers.
The only keynote speaker.
Okay, the only keynote speaker. And I will be talking about liberating the authentic healer within and also connecting that to the world we live in. You'll be also lecturing. There'll be room for questions and answers. There'll be a social environment afterwards. So there's a whole lot going on. So please call. And could you give us a number people can call for information in the website?
Sure. The website is meaningfulworld.com. Meaningfulworld, one word, .com. And the telephone is 201-941-2266.
All right. Give that number again, please.
201-941-2266.
By the way, Dr. Annie is also the chair of the United Nations Working Group on Health Transformation and Spirituality. So thank you very much for inviting me to be there. I will be there. The conference is on nurturing resilient and sustainable communities. I'll talk about what I believe should be the ideal look of a community and how it should function in the future, starting with self. So I'm going to be there.
Emphasize, Gary, is that we will have other speakers that will be bringing up-to-date research as well as integrative modalities for mind, body, spirit health, as well as we start with meditation and sound energy healing. We'll have musicians working, playing spiritual and healing songs, while we have members that would do yoga movements just to show how that works to connect our body and mind and spirit, as well as focusing how environment can impact us, and we therefore impact the environment as well. And we will have also the graduates of A Meaningful World, with which they will be Meaningful World ambassadors, and they will receive their graduation diplomas and awards the same day as well.
Well, it'll be a wonderful day. Thank you very much. I'll be there.
Wonderful. Great to hear that, and for anybody with questions, this is a free conference. Everyone is welcome. Phone again is 201-941-2266, and you can visit the website at meaningfulworld.com.
Thank you.
I hope to see everybody there.
All right. It's free, and it's going to be a wonderful day, and I'll be there, and it's at the United Nations. And we're up to the end of our program. I just was told that Luann is on the line, so we'll just say hello quickly to Luann. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. As always, great show, great information. I don't know if I have time to read an email to you or if you want to wait for next time. I still, by the way, have one opening. I interviewed about 15 people yesterday, so I still have one opening for the retreat in June. So if people want to call me, they can at 631-504-6198, 631-504-6198.
Why don't you hold your question till our next program, because Danny Schechter is starting, and he is, I believe, interviewing Dan Rather, so we want to hear that interview.
Great.
All right. Have a nice day, everyone. I'll be here at 8 o'clock Sunday evening live talking about health and nutrition. And I'll be back here Monday on WBAI and Progressive Radio Network live show. Have a nice weekend, everyone.